So let's get rolling. As usual, any of our legal programs, one, we're going to talk about the law today. And I say it's the law, assuming your judge will is willing to properly apply the law. So it's the law as it is. Now, policy can be more restrictive, obviously, and some of these topics we'll talk about today, it's not uncommon to see policy being restrictive. So make sure you're following policy. Any doubts about anything you see in here, you push up the chain, back at your agency, let somebody of higher ranking authority make the call on how we're going to do business there. And if, as always, this is legal education, legal awareness, not legal advice. All right. And we're going to talk about the federal standard of all these things. We're going to talk about the federal standard here. State law, as those of you who work in those states where there are more restrictive aspects of criminal procedure, just understand, obviously, you can be more restrictive, but these are the federal standards. All right. So 10, the top 10, well, I should say top 10. These are just 10 common search and seizure myths. I don't have them ranked in any particular order. But these are just 10 things that I've over the years of teaching search and seizure to different levels of officers that have commonly hear misinformation about or misunderstanding. So we're going to try and cover them quickly and get these myths dispelled. Number one. There's a probable cause exception to the search warrant requirement. I've even heard prosecutors tell us that if you've got probable cause, that's enough to search and seize. And that's simply not true. Remember, CREW, here at Blue to Gold, we've got the CREW acronym, which I love this rule because unlike most legal rules that have exceptions, this one, there are none. And so all searches and seizures require CREW in order to make them law. So just having there's no PC in this acronym. Probable cause is it's a prerequisite for getting a warrant or for relying on some of the recognized exceptions, but it's not enough by itself. Just because I have probable cause to believe there's drugs inside of a house. We all know that I can't just walk up to the door and open the door and walk in, right? I need to either get consent from someone who has the apparent authority to grant it, or go get a search warrant, or maybe I have a recognized exception, which in home entry, that would be potentially exigent circumstances. So everything requires CREW. PC, again, standing by itself is not an exception. And this is just one quote of many that you'll see. I just picked a case from New Jersey that I stumbled across the other day, just reaffirming that principle. Just because I've got PC isn't going to get me all the way to search and seizure. It is, like I said, a prerequisite for many, well, for all warrants, at least all criminal warrants, and many of our recognized exceptions. Okay, so myth number one, there's no such thing as a PC exception to the search warrant requirement. All right. Number two, what do we have? A person who's not free to leave cannot give valid consent to search. Again, I hear this one all the time, and this is particularly true, or I particularly hear this in the context of traffic stops. And I've heard many a prosecutor say to an officer, hey, if you're going to be seeking consent on a traffic stop, you can only do it after you've completed the stop and handed back all the documents and converted it into a consensual encounter. You can't ask during the stop because no one's free to leave. And even if they do consent, it's coerced by virtue of the fact that they're not free to leave. And that simply isn't true. In 50 years ago, the Supreme Court addressed this issue and said, no, just because someone is in custody or being detained does not render the consent invalid. As long, well, in Watson, this guy, he's under arrest. And the police asked for consent to search his car, which he gives. And he argued later on, well, I was my consent was not voluntary. It was coerced because of this custodial environment. And Supreme Court says that's simply not true. You can get a confession from someone. and who's under arrest, we can have someone confess to a capital crime. All right, and that could be admissible as long as it meets the voluntariness standard. So if we can use a confession from someone who's under arrest as evidence in a criminal case, we can certainly get valid permission to rummage through their property as long as it's otherwise voluntary. So yeah, as long as the consent is voluntary, we can get consent from someone who's in custody. Of course, the key is going to be, is the detention or the arrest, is it lawful? You know, if on a traffic stop, if I've extended the duration of this stop unreasonably without supporting reasonable suspicion, and then I ask for consent, yeah, that's probably going to be an invalid consent as a product of that illegal detention. So as long as the detention remains lawful, the consent should be fine as long as we ask nicely, no threats, no promises, no undue coercion. And here's a case from Idaho that the consent was given during an unlawful detention. Therefore, the consent is no, it's not valid. There wasn't sufficient, the legal term is attenuation. There weren't enough circumstances during or after the illegal detention that kind of took the taint out of that detention. So yes, a valid consent can come from someone who's detained. Now this has taken on more of a significant role, this detention and consent. It's been more significant since Rodriguez. If I was going to do a top 10 list of most frequently litigated Fourth Amendment cases in criminal court today, Rodriguez would definitely be in the top probably three. Well, I call them Rodriguez issues. It seems like every other motion to suppress that is filed in criminal courts across America today involves some kind of Rodriguez issue, usually on a traffic stop where the argument is the officer has extended or prolonged the stop, okay, and got consent during, for example, during that detention. And so Rodriguez is all about time. So I just want to make sure we remember that, you know, we're focused on the mission. We're not extending the stop, extending the duration to basically fish around or chase butterflies. Okay, so now, well, interesting. One of the things that I thought was interesting about the Rodriguez case was the officer in this case, he scratches out a warning particularly quickly for this traffic violation, and he ends up he wants to run his canine around the car, and he asks the driver after he hands back all the documents, he asks if they'd be willing to wait for his backup to get there so he can deploy the canine, and they said no, we'd like to leave, and the officer says, well, that's fine, you're not free to leave, you're gonna remain here anyway. So the stop is over, traffic mission's been addressed, he continues to detain them for 7 or 8 minutes until his partner arrives. Then they deploy the dog, and finally the dog alerts. And so it's that 7 or 8 minute detention that is at issue in this case. And one of the things, of course, the Supreme Court says, no, that's an illegal detention. You don't have reasonable suspicion to support that. And one of the arguments the U.S. attorney put forth is, well, wait a minute, Your Honor, this particular officer was so efficient and expedient with his warning that he wrote, like he wrote it so quickly. The average officer would take, say, oh, 7 or 8 more minutes to write this warning. So this officer should get bonus time, to this free 7 or 8 minutes of just play time to do whatever he wants to do. And the Supreme Court says no, that's not a thing. There's no bonus time. And I ran across this case last year where that same argument was being made that this officer the government wants bonus time for an officer being particularly efficient, and that's just not the case. When you're done, you're done. No matter how long it would have taken the average officer to get that taken care of. Now, again, it's not that we can't ask for consent without reasonable suspicion or ask unrelated questions, that we can't, it's that we can't do it in a way that prolongs the stop. Okay, so Rodriguez again is all about time. All right. So, all right, that was number two, consent. We can get consent from someone who is lawfully detained or arrested. Number three, I can enter any home to make an arrest When I know the arrestee is inside right now, I can see him through the window, or I've got information from a reliable source that he's inside, and that's simply not true. Any home, I can't make entry into any home. So the rule for entering homes is it's crude. Where we need consent, warrant, or the only recognized exception is exigency. But there's different types of exigencies. But with warrant, we're normally thinking search warrant, but an arrest warrant, it will do the trick. Okay, but not every house. Okay, there's a specific. Two specific requirements. It comes from Peyton versus New York. Which houses can we enter to make an arrest with only an arrest warrant, no consent and no exigency? It's the place where we believe the arrestee lives and where we believe he's present inside right now. So the two requirements, you've got to have a reasonable belief, is the term used by the Supreme Court. Reasonable belief that the arrestee's inside. And a reasonable belief that the arrestee is inside right now. Okay. So it's now he doesn't have to, this is not about property law. He doesn't have to have a possessory interest in the house. Like he doesn't have to own the house or be on the lease. It's just, is this the place where the person resides or reasonably believes to be residing? Then we can go inside with the belief that he's also inside. Now we don't have to know. We don't have to know he's inside, but we've got to have some fair probability. A good question officers ask on this one is, do I have to hold the warrant in my hand? And the answer is no. Legally, no. I mean, I think it's a good idea as a practical matter to have that document. You need to know it exists, though. It's not enough to just run an NCIC check and find out that there's an NCIC hit that the owner of this house has a warrant. We need to have a confirmation from that. But it's not an absolute requirement. You hold it in your hand. Does the address on the warrant have to match the house we want to enter? And the answer here is also no. This is not a search warrant. It's an arrest warrant. And it's not an arrest warrant that serves as a search warrant, as I've heard some people say. It's an arrest warrant that serves as an arrest warrant. It authorizes an arrest and authorizes an entry into a particular place, which is the place where the person lives. And what's written on the warrant doesn't matter. What matters is the belief that the person lives there. It's the warrant itself that gives the authority to go inside. We don't put addresses on arrest warrants to justify entry into the house. We put addresses on arrest warrants for the same reason. Put his name on there, or is his date of birth. It's part of his description. Change the address doesn't change who the guy is. Does the seriousness of the underlying offense matter for purposes of entry? And the answer here also is no. Peyton was about a felony case. Actually, Peyton was really about a warrantless entry. But when they started talking about this arrest warrant little carve out, it was all in the context of felonies. But the lower courts have also said that it can be for a misdemeanor as well. It's the piece of paper. It's the fact that a judicial official has authorized the arrest that justifies the entry, not what's written on it. Now, are there other things that an officer should consider before you go barging inside someone's home to make an arrest? Sure, maybe there's some state law restrictions. Some states do have rules about service of warrants at homes after certain hours of the day. Policy needs to be considered. Hopefully, this is something that is addressed in a policy that might want to limit what hours we go banging on doors, barging inside. I mean, in some parts of the country, people shoot first and ask questions later when people kick their door in at, say, 3 o'clock in the morning. And maybe doing so for a traffic warrant isn't the most reasonable thing to do. And don't forget, of course, common sense and good judgment. But here, let me do one other scenario. So going back to kind of the myth part, it doesn't matter whose house he's in. Of course it matters. Let's say we have an arrest warrant for a fellow named Greg, and Greg's wanted for felony property damage. All right, so it's a felony, yes, but it's really not that serious of a crime. It's a property crime. So we go to his, we know Greg. Everybody in this jurisdiction knows Greg. We know what he looks like. We know where he lives. We go to his house. We knock on the door. His wife answers the door, and we say, "Hey, is Greg here?" She says, "No, he's not." We said, "Well, do you know where he is?" She says, "Yeah, he's down the street at his grandmother's house." I said, "Well, how do you know that?" She says, "Well, it's Wednesday night, and every Wednesday he goes to his grandmother's house right about this time, and she fixes him a little plate of spaghetti, and the two of them they sit there in the living room or the kitchen. They have a plate of a little spaghetti dinner together, just the two of them, and then they adjourn to the living room and they watch Jeopardy. They do this every Wednesday night," she says. "In fact, it's the highlight of his week." Now, having, let's say we have no reason to believe that she is lying to us. We have no reason to believe he's there. Then let's, so we have, so no reason to believe he's there. We head to grandma's house, which is right down the street. We go to grandma's house and we knock on the door, and grandma comes to the door. And there's Rick there. So grandma, she opens the door all the way, and we can see inside from we're on the porch as she opens the door. You can see inside there he is. There's Greg in the kitchen eating his spaghetti dinner. He looks up and he waves to us, so we wave back to him. So you know we know he's inside. He knows we're out here. And we say to grandma, who's standing in the doorway, "Grandma, listen, we have a warrant for your grandson's arrest. It's not the crime of the century. Don't get too alarmed." And we say, "All we need from you, grandma, real simple, a little scooch off to the left or a little scooch off to the right, whichever's more convenient to you, so we can come inside and make this arrest." And she says, "Officer, well, first and foremost, I want to thank you for all that you do in service to our community. I rest comfortably knowing you guys are out here patrolling our streets. However, Wednesday nights are very important to my grandson and I. And you know, he comes over every Wednesday. We have spaghetti. We're about to adjourn to the living room, watch Jeopardy. We do this every Wednesday night. And as you know, officer," she points to her watch on her wrist, "Jeopardy is about to start. So, as politely as I can, I'm going to decline your request to come inside my home and bid you a good evening." So that's what we have. We know he's inside. We're also pretty sure, well, we know he doesn't live here. Because remember, we know Greg. We know he's just here having a quick plate of spaghetti and watching some Jeopardy. So let's, so what do we need to go inside? Well, we tried consent. Okay, that doesn't seem like that's forthcoming in the next 30 minutes or so. We don't have an exigency, at least I don't think we do. You're like, someone, well, he could escape. Yeah, but he's not going to be some kind of menace to society. He's a property crime suspect. So we need a warrant. And do we have the right kind of warrant? And the answer here is we don't. And this, we need a search warrant, as Andrew and William noted in the comments. We need a search warrant because this is not about protecting Greg's rights. This is about protecting grandma's rights in her home. These are called third-party premises cases where the arrestee is in someone else's home. And as you can read for yourself, the Supreme Court's in Stigall says only a search warrant will protect the homeowner's rights. In some states even call these Stigall warrants, these types of search warrants. And now some of you are listening, and some people in my classes, they want to arrest grandma for obstruction of justice or hindering apprehension or harboring a fugitive, because she won't let us come in knowing full well we have an arrest warrant for her grandson. Well, even if you open up the state criminal code statute that's, you know, she's allegedly violating, she, let's say she's doing everything on that list, like every element is accounted for. So she is committing the state law crime of harboring a fugitive, let's say. Well, what is she also doing? The Supreme Court says she's exercising her Fourth Amendment rights. So we have a conflict of laws. We have federal constitutional law versus state criminal law. And the federal Constitution says the answer is federal law is supreme. Article 6, clause, the second clause 2, the supremacy clause. Federal law, when it conflicts with state law, will preempt or trump or overrule state law. So even though she might be committing a state law crime, it would be unconstitutional to effect the arrest. Now I show back up with a search warrant, and we have the same song and dance. Now we can talk about arrest. Now some states have many, actually many states in their Code of Criminal Procedure have a statute very similar to this one. I'm using Ohio's as an example, that if you read it on its face, it sounds like it authorizes entry into any home. When you knock on the door, let them know you have a warrant for someone's arrest, and they don't let you inside. That certainly is what the statute says. But again, we go back to the Supremacy Clause. Federal law, the Fourth Amendment, trumps state law. So even though there's a state statute that says you can go inside anybody else's, and Sean, I will take a look at that Iowa statute. Iowa's got some very interesting criminal procedure statutes, as you probably well know. Actually, New York had a very similar statute that was at issue in the Peyton case. So just because state law says you can go in doesn't mean it is comporting with the Fourth Amendment. All right, so no, we can't go into any home to make an entry for an arrest, if just even if we know the arrestee's inside. It's not a search, it's an inventory. We can dispose of this one very quickly. I've had, many people will argue that don't call it an inventory search, call it an inventory in your testimony and your documentation, because it sounds like you're looking for evidence. Otherwise, that's just a semantic argument that's actually not true. It is a search. Because, well, a search is an intrusion upon an expectation of privacy. When you rummage through someone's car, you're intruding upon their privacy. The same thing, if a search is also an intrusion to a constitutionally protected area, tend to gather information, which is exactly what I'm doing during an inventory process. It's a search. If it wasn't a search, it wouldn't be governed by the Fourth Amendment. It's just a different type of search. It is an administrative search. Based upon the officer's community caretaking authority. Almost all the Supreme Court cases that talk about inventories call them searches, going all the way back to Katie versus Dombrowski, which is not really an inventory search, it's a community caretaking search, but that's where the authority comes from. So, they call it a search there, they call it a search in Opperman, call it a search in Florida versus Wells. So, all the there, it's a search. It's a search. Okay. Now, two things are required to make a lawful inventory search, as always: lawful police order tow, and the officer is following some kind of standardized criteria that his agency has in place. Just real quickly, this case out of North Dakota, worst case, this is like, obviously we can't use inventory searches as pretext to look for evidence. And a lot of times the issue that's litigated is, was the towing lawful? Did it serve some kind of governmental purpose? And so here's the worst possible case scenario that I can think of. We're doing a clearly an in a pretextual inventory in this case out of North Dakota, Crawl. In fact, the officers go back and forth for a long period of time. They want to search this car. They think, I think, if I remember correctly, they're looking for drugs or some other kind of contraband. So they come up with, well, let's tow the car so we can search it. And they open the trunk, and lo and behold, there is a dead body in the trunk. They were not expecting to find that. Turns out she's a homicide victim. The crawl guy, the owner of the car, is the offender. He's also, after a long investigation, eventually arrested, and the body ends up getting suppressed because the inventory search was clearly a pretext for a search for evidence. Now, fortunately, there was enough circumstantial evidence to get a conviction anyway for this crime. But I can tell you what, we dodged a huge bullet. I guarantee you, there were some very nervous and patrol officers and detectives in North Dakota on this case. So, no pretextual inventory searches. All right, number five. It's in plain view. I can seize, if it is in plain view, I can seize it without a warrant. And that's, so just because you can see something doesn't mean you can necessarily seize it. The plain view doctrine has some very particular requirements. Everything that is in plain view is not subject to the plain view doctrine. Just because I can see drugs inside of a house, just because I could see Greg inside of grandma's house, doesn't mean I can just walk inside. Okay, I have to have at least, well, three things. There have to be three, there's three elements to the plain view doctrine. If they don't apply, then I have to rely on some other recognized exception. The first requirement is that you have to be lawfully in the place where that item is. And this is usually the sticking point, is wherever the item is, you've got to be there lawfully as well. The plain view doctrine does not authorize warrantless searches. It authorizes warrantless seizures. So, if we're standing outside this car and we look inside and we see narcotics in plain view, Yeah, we've got probable cause to believe there's drugs in there. I'm assuming training experience. But the plain view doctrine doesn't get this officer in the car because the first requirement is not met. She's not lawfully in the car at this point where the item is. So she can either go get a warrant or maybe rely on a recognized exception like the automobile exception here. But it's not plain view doctrine that's getting inside the car. If she was in the car, say maybe doing an inventory search, then and she opens the glove box and sees narcotics in plain view, then now we can talk about plain view doctrine authorizing a warrantless seizure of those drugs. The second requirement is that the item's got to be in plain view. This sounds obvious, but it means which what it means that you can't move stuff out of the way to be able to see it. You can't be using an unusual vantage point, like say climbing up a tree with a pair of binoculars, peering into a second floor window. Yeah, the drugs we see in that window might be in plain view, but the vantage point the officer is using is an unusual vantage point. So that would not wouldn't do the trick in that particular case. We call it the peeping Tom rule. If you're doing something as an officer that if a private citizen saw someone doing that, they'd probably call the police, then it's probably not a normal vantage point. And then the third requirement is that you've got to have obviously probable cause to seize the item. And the probable cause has to pre-exists the touching. It's got to exist before you touch the item, and it cannot obviously involve any manipulation of the item. So before you put your hands on the item, then you have to have PC. And the quintessential case on this is Arizona versus Hicks. The like how it doesn't take much for the touching to be unlawful, but this is a case where officers respond to a, I think it's a shooting, like someone had fired a round into a neighboring apartment, so they go to the apartment where the round they believe came from. They do a entry under the emergency aid doctrine to make sure there's nobody hurt. They secure the premises, nobody's injured. They're about to leave, and one of the officers, it's a really just cheap, dingy, rundown apartment, not a lot of furniture, but he notices this very expensive stereo equipment, including this turntable. It just looked out of place. It was very high end, so he's thinking this might be stolen. So he picks up the turntable, he looks underneath, and he can see the serial number printed underneath, and he jots it down and ends up running it after they leave. And it, sure enough, it's stolen. And they come back and get a warrant to seize the property. And the Supreme Court said, well, of course, they were relying on the plain view doctrine for their probable cause. And the Supreme Court says, yeah, but when you moved the turntable to see, you couldn't see the serial number from your vantage point. So you had to move it. And that was a search, okay? And so this is it's no good. It's no good. We're missing the third prong of the plain view doctrine here. We had to manipulate the item ever so slightly to get our probable cause. So that's not going to work. Okay. All right. So just because you can see it doesn't mean you can seize it. All right. The next myth, number six. When I'm searching a vehicle, either an incident to arrest search or a frisk, I can only search the lunge area of the arrestee or the person who I believe is armed and dangerous. So we're confined to what seat did the person come out of and where could they reach from that seat? Those are the only places I can search. And that's just simply not true. If that is how you're doing your vehicle frisks and incident to arrest searches, then you're actually limiting yourself. You're missing a substantial part of the vehicle. So let's do search incident to arrest first, because the vehicle frisk builds off of that. So New York versus Belton is our case on this issue for the search incident to arrest. Belton is the where you can look case. Arizona versus Gant, Miker, is it Miker? Miker Galley is mentioning Gant did change, he did change the rule. Gant is the when you can search case. Now the when changed. Gant changed the, I'm sorry, Mike. The when changed in Arizona versus Gant, but not the where. The where you can search still holds true. And Belton, as you can see, it says you can search the entire passenger compartment. which naturally excludes part of the vehicle. So the trunk is typically not within the scope. Mike says, which is the what? Belton is the where in the vehicle can I search case. Arizona versus Gantt is when can I do the vehicle search incident to arrest. So it's about, we're talking about search incident to arrest. When can I do it? Gantt's going to answer that question. And it would be when I'm looking for evidence of the crime of the arrest. So that's what I'm looking for. And that comes from Gantt. Then now I need to know, well, where can I search? And Belton says, you can search the entire passenger compartment and all the containers inside that are obviously capable of housing what you're looking for. So we got to think about the proper scope. But it's not limited. The point I want to emphasize here is it's not limited to where the person was seated. The seating position in the vehicle is irrelevant. Whether the arrestee, the drunk driver, could reach the backpack that's sitting at the, you know, it's maybe, let's say it's one of those long passenger vans, like three or four rows of bench seats that a church might have. There's a backpack on one of those far back seats. That's part of the passenger compartment. Evidence of DUI could be in there. It doesn't matter if the arrestee could physically reach that area. What matters is the area within the passenger compartment, and is it reasonable to believe could the item you're looking for fit in the container in this case? And the answer is yes, it could be searched. So it's not limited to where the person can reach. And the same is true with the frisk. All right, so the vehicle frisk, that's Michigan versus Long. What's a vehicle frisk? It is a protective search looking in areas where a weapon could be located inside of a vehicle and quickly accessed by someone. Yes, Anthony Smith, this is separate from the automobile exception. The search incident to arrest is an is it's a whole it's a standalone recognized exception to the warrant requirement. Arizona versus Gantt, New York versus Belton are your cases there. The automobile exception comes from Carroll. And then this one we're talking about now, this is another recognized exception, which is the vehicle frisk, and that comes from Michigan versus Long. They are three distinct searches with different rules, different things we're looking for. We will talk about the automobile exception here in just a moment with one of our myths. But a frisk, we're looking for weapons. And like I said, Michigan versus Long is our case. And the rule for when we can frisk is it's basically Michigan versus Long is Terry versus Ohio for cars. So you got to have a lawful stop of the vehicle and its occupants. And then you've got to have a reasonable suspicion to believe there's a dangerous weapon inside the vehicle, inside the passenger compartment. Yeah, Mike, Pennsylvania doesn't have the automobile exception. And Pennsylvania, surprisingly to me anyway, there isn't any case, at least there wasn't 6 months ago, any case law on the Arizona versus Gantt and the search incident to arrest. But I would be a little surprised if Pennsylvania did recognize Gantt, but not the automobile exception. So. But make you want to check your state law on that. All right, so but where can I look? I can search the entire passenger compartment, and this case emphasizes that point. So in Michigan versus Long, the Supreme Court referenced New York versus Belton when it talked about the scope. We already learned Belton says where you can search the entire passenger compartment. And that's the same exact scope under the frisk. So I can, it doesn't, if, let's say there's just a driver in the vehicle and I believe there's a dangerous weapon in the vehicle. Where can I search? Well, anywhere in the passenger compartment that weapon could be located and quickly accessed. Now, of course, the driver, I'm assuming he's not going to be in the vehicle when you're frisking. I have a hard time imagining we're going to be crawling over top of occupants looking for weapons on traffic stops. We're going to have them removed, but that doesn't affect my ability to do the frisk. Of course, they're going to be out of the vehicle. So he might not have access to the weapons now that I suspect they're in there because I've taken them away from the vehicle. But if this is just a detention, okay, not an arrest, he's going to be very likely returning to his vehicle. So that's the reason we can search the whole passenger compartment for these weapons, because now he's out of the vehicle. And as he returns to the vehicle, he has much more access to the entire area. So it doesn't matter if you've taken the person out, you can still do the frisk because of this protective reason. That's assuming. Everybody's not under arrest. If you've arrested everyone, then there's no vehicle frisk. Sean, did New Jersey lose the automobile exception? They lost it, and then I think did they get it back? Is it the Witt case? I forget, but it might be limited. It's got to have the spontaneous, unforeseeable encounter with the vehicle. I think is one of the requirements. But yet, New Jersey has a limited automobile exception. All right, so we're not limited to just the lunging area, the reaching distance on our searches incident to arrest and our vehicle frisks. Number seven, you can never unarrest someone. I was taught this in our academy that once you make an arrest, that's it. There's no such thing as unarrest. And I didn't really think of it much at the time. I mean, obviously, I remembered it because here I am 20 years later talking about it, but I didn't think critically about it. But, of course, you can unarrest someone. You, if I don't, how many people can you have under arrest legally without probable cause? None, right? And can you have PC at one moment and then learn new information that negates or dispels your probable cause? Sure. Probable cause leaves room for being mistaken. Now, if I've made an arrest, and I have yet to commit this person to a detention facility. So it's between arrest and arrival and commitment to the detention facility. So this is the time frame we're talking about. And I lose my PC on the way to the jail. You know, my partner calls me up on the cell phone and says, "Hey, I've got some new information that you're not going to like. You got the wrong guy." Well, he's got to be unarrested at that point, you know. So how do you unarrest someone? What's the procedure? Real simply, you turn if he's in the back of my car, I turn over my right shoulder, and I say, "Hey, man, you're not under arrest anymore." And as soon as I find a safe place to pull over, we'll get those handcuffs off of you, and we'll get you to a nearby safe location. But you're not under arrest anymore, and that's it. That's unarrest, right? Now, of course, we're going to want to document that somewhere because we made an arrest and we never actually took him to jail. Now, if after he's been committed to the detention facility and we develop new information that's not the right guy, then now we need to get the prosecutor involved because we can't just walk up to the jail and order and tell the sheriff to let him out. But so pre-confinement, loss of probable cause. Of course, you have to unarrest that person. Now, a lot, but officers get heartburn with that. Like, well, wait a minute. Now he's going to sue me. No. What's going to cause you to get sued? Well, first of all, anybody can sue anybody. I can go right down to every one of your courthouses tomorrow and sue every single. I can pull a list of everybody who's here tonight, and I'm going to sue every one of you tomorrow. Okay, this is America. Anyone can sue anybody. Exactly. We should. Let's divide up the country into segments and let's just go just file lawsuits like haphazardly, right? They're not going to go anywhere. Okay, what we need to be worried about are the suits that we could potentially lose. And what's a good way to lose this suit? Keep the guy under arrest after you lose your probable cause. That's what is going to get you sued. Probable cause leaves room for being mistaken. And I think sometimes we forget that. You know, how many people get arrested and then we go to trial and they're found not guilty? Okay. Does that mean you illegally arrested that person? No, it means we didn't have enough. We had enough information to begin the formal prosecution of this person, but we didn't have enough to convict the person. Okay, there's a big gap between probable cause and beyond a reasonable doubt. So the very notion of probable cause and certainly reasonable suspicion leave room for being wrong. And when we lose PC, it doesn't happen often. Okay, but when we lose PC, you gotta let them go. Well, what about changing your mind? Anthony says, so I've made an arrest, I still have PC. I don't think the Fourth Amendment would have any problem with you releasing that person. I think maybe your agency would, policy, maybe some state criminal procedure. But as long as we haven't had this guy in custody for more, as long as it's not a warrantless arrest and we've had him in custody for more than 72 hours before seeing a judicial official, okay, because he's got to be promptly brought before a judicial official. If it's been a warrantless arrest, then we got to get him over there. But can I change my mind and just unarrest somebody? Sure. Under Fourth Amendment purposes. And I knew this was where you were going. What about, you know, we do the arrest so we can do the search incident to arrest. We don't like what we find because we didn't find anything. Can we let them go? I think under the Fourth Amendment, I think you can. And I think the Atwater case and Wren and Knowles versus Iowa, all three of them would support that. But I don't think, as a matter of policy, if I was the chief or the sheriff for your agency, I would not condone that kind of behavior. I would be, if you make an arrest and you do a search incident arrest, I don't care what you find, you need to finish the arrest process. Legally, probably a sound policy, but not, I'm sorry, a sound practice, but not very wise, I think, as a practical matter. But anyway, okay, but unarrest. Yes, we can unarrest people. What do we have? Number eight. If you have time to get a warrant, you need a warrant to search a car. And again, we're talking federal standards. So my friends from New Mexico, Pennsylvania, you can take a quick nap. Alaska, again, nap time. Who else was on? Who New Jer well, New Jersey, you still have it. Who? But Washington State, Hawaii, Vermont. Is it Vermont? Vermont or New Hampshire? One of the two. I think it's Vermont. Doesn't have the automobile exception either. But under the Fourth Amendment, rarely is a warrant legally required to search a car if you have probable cause, or actually for any reason, because most car searches fall into at least one of our recognized exceptions. But can you ever, and all we're talking about is what the law is, can you ever be wrong? Okay, New Hampshire needs a warrant for cars. Okay, so I had it backwards. New Hampshire is no Carroll doctrine. Can you ever be wrong if you get the if you go get a search warrant? Can it ever be wrong? No, as an officer, unless you're disobeying an order, which I can't imagine someone would order you not to get a warrant. But no, it's never wrong. But legally, it's just not required. Now, here's one place I do suggest to officers, like if you're thinking about searching a car and you're wavering on whether you have probable cause, then yes, then please by all means go seek a search warrant and let the judicial official make that determination. But if you're confident, I mean, you know you've got PC because you see evidence in plain view, or just you can smell the odor of marijuana wherever it is. Then you know the PC is not an issue. You don't have to have a warrant, okay, for cars. And the primary reason is the Carroll Doctrine, Carroll versus the United States, which is 100 years old this year. It's one of the oldest Fourth Amendment cases, but not quite the oldest, but one of the oldest. And it's Carroll's all about how cars and wagons and boats are different from houses and stores and structures. The mobility of cars creates this type of exigency. Urgency. Now, the term exigency, if I remember correctly, is not in Carroll, but that's what they're talking about. And there's no question about it. The initial what we call today Carroll Doctrine was premised on exigent circumstances. No time to get a warrant. But over the years, up to today, how do I pronounce guarantee? Guarantee. Guarantee, right? Yeah, the guarantee. That's, I think yeah, guarantee. Guarantee. That's how I pronounce it. I don't know if that's how Taft pronounces it. What was I saying? Oh, the 1925. It was the first Carroll Doctrine case. Well, obviously from the Carroll case. Now we've had 100. We've had 25 cases. The Supreme Court has heard a total of 25 cases, counting Carroll, dealing with the automobile exception one way or another. They have expanded it considerably from what it initially was, starting in the 1970s, to the point that today, if you were to ask me to put in my own words, like what does the Carroll Doctrine say, I'd say it's this. I say if you've got a vehicle that's readily mobile, and I'll define that term in just a second, it's readily mobile, and you've got probable cause to believe it's got evidence or contraband, and you have a right to be where the vehicle is. So that last part, a lawful right of access to the vehicle, wherever the vehicle is, you have to have a right to be there as well. If you have those things, then you can search the entire vehicle bumper to bumper, a full search of the vehicle looking for that evidence or contraband. Nowhere in there do you see the term or the qualifier, and you don't have time to get a warrant, or there are exigent circumstances. under the federal standard, there is no exigency requirement anymore. It was slowly being chipped away at in the 1970s, and it was done away with by the early 1980s. And this quote from Maryland versus Dyson, just one example of many, that says there is no longer a separate exigency requirement. We don't have to show there isn't time to get a warrant anymore under the federal standard. We do need to show the vehicle's readily mobile. And what does that term mean? It's just a term of art, really. It means operational. It's capable of movement. It has four wheels on it if it's a car, and I have no reason to believe it doesn't have an engine in the engine compartment. It's capable of movement is all we have to show. We don't have to show that it is likely or even possible that someone's going to move it for purposes of the Carroll Doctrine. And so the cases that prove this point, the cases where we're searching cars at like impound lots, so Michigan versus Thomas is the search occurred later that day, so it's still the same day, but they encounter the vehicle on the side of the road. He gets towed to the police station and searched there. They had PC to search on the side of the road. They search it there, and of course the argument from Thomas says, "Hey, where's your warrant? You had plenty of time to stop off and get one." And the Supreme Court says they don't need one. The Carroll Doctrine applies regardless whether you move the vehicle to another location, as long as it is an operational vehicle. United States versus Johns, 3 days later. Yeah, Mike Bliss, an RV. California versus Carney, as long as the RV is being used at that particular moment, more like a vehicle than it's being used as a residence, then it is covered under Carroll. California versus Carney, 1985, I think is the year, for 86 or 85. U.S. versus Johns, here's a 3 days later search. This was a traffic stop where the DEA searches Johns's pickup truck. They find these three packages. They're looking for drugs. I don't remember why they didn't open them on the side of the road, but they didn't. They took them back to their warehouse. And 3 days later, they get around to opening them. I guess it was Friday. DEA doesn't work on the weekends. So Monday morning, or like probably after lunch Monday, they decided to open them, and there was marijuana in the packages, but they never got a warrant. And the Supreme Court says they didn't need one because it's still covered by Carroll. And to me, the perfect example of having time to get a warrant doesn't mean you need one is Gastuborough. Here we have a traffic stop from a trooper in Northern Virginia, searches a car looking for drugs, finds a bunch of cocaine in the car, arrests Gastuborough, seizes his car, federally indicted for trafficking cocaine. And then 38 days later, the trooper, I think he's at one of the preliminary hearings at the courthouse, and he's approached by the girlfriend of Gastuborough, who was in the car on the day of the stop. And she says, "Hey, did you find the gun that he had in the car that day?" And this is important because he's a convicted felon, not supposed to have it. And the trooper says, "No, I didn't find a gun." She says, "Well, I know it was in there because when you pulled us over, I watched him tuck the gun behind the radio." So he pulls the radio out of the dashboard, but he puts it back there. And so the trooper's thinking, "Well, that's why I didn't find it. I didn't look back there." So he goes to the impound lot where the car's been sitting the entire time. He pulls the radio out of the dash. There it is. There's the gun and a bunch more cocaine. And of course, new charges for Gastro. And his argument is, "You've had my car for almost 6 weeks. You need a warrant." And the Fourth Circuit is very sympathetic to Gastro. And they say, "Well, that's a good point. No, that's a long time to not have a warrant. But let's first consult Supreme Court case law." And they found the U.S. versus Johns case, the one we just talked about, where the court says 3 days later, you don't need a warrant. So the Fourth Circuit says, "Well, what's 35 more days? If you don't need a warrant after 3 days, then we don't see what difference 35 more days makes." So no warrant required under the Carroll Doctrine in this particular case. Now, these are all vehicles that are in police custody in these cases here. Does this change if the car is sitting down at Cooter's tow lot? No, it doesn't. We've got some pretty significant chain of custody issues if we're talking about 38 days now over at Cooter's lot, but we don't have any search and seizure issues. All right, so got time to get a warrant doesn't mean you have to have one under the Fourth Amendment. I can search any item, number nine, I can search any items that unrest he has in his possession at the time of his arrest. And this is just not true. Well, at least no, it's not an automatic. And we've got a bunch of federal cases now that talk about this. These items like backpacks and purses and luggage and grocery bags, so things that people would be carrying with them, and we arrest that person. Can we search the backpack that he was wearing, but we took it off of him so we could put him in handcuffs? And we put the bag on the trunk of the police car, and we lock him inside the police car. Is that a search incident to arrest? And the trend in the federal courts is clearly towards the answer is no. You're supposed to be looking for weapons that he could attack you with and evidence he could destroy. You've taken the backpack away from him. He doesn't have access to it anymore. So it's not the justification for search incident to arrest just isn't there. So there's a bunch of cases. And they rely heavily, by the way, on Arizona versus Gant, our vehicle search case. Same thing, fanny pack. You take it off of him. You take his access away to it from it. Then we run into some potential issues. And the 10th Circuit does a good job of talking about, well, what factors do courts look at to determine whether can we search the backpack? Can we search the fanny pack? Again, we've removed it from the arrestee. Then we want to search it. How close is the arrestee still standing near it? Because that's we could argue he still has access to it. Evan, stand by. Inventory. That's actually where we need to be thinking on this thing, not search incident to arrest. These are different searches. Search incident to arrest is a protective search. Make sure he doesn't attack me with a weapon or escape or destroy evidence. Okay. But when I've limited his access or I've taken away his access to an area, I don't need to search those things. But what if we need to take those items with him to the jail? That's where the inventory search comes in, which again, it's a different type of a search. It's still, I mean, we're still searching it. They look the same, but they're called different things because they are different things and they have different requirements. Illinois versus Lafayette is one of our there's one of two Supreme Court cases. The United States versus Edwards is the other one, where it's an inventory search, not in the context of a vehicle search. And they talk about these kinds of things. Yes, it is reasonable to search an arrestee's belongings prior to committing him to the jail. Now, Lafayette is a search at the jail. But it's interesting that in Lafayette, there's no language in the opinion that suggests this thing has to be done at the jail. It can be done in the field, and there's numerous cases out there upholding what I call field inventory searches. This is just one example here out of the 10th Circuit. Of course, as with all inventory searches, what do you have to have? You got to have a policy or some kind of administrative procedure that authorizes and tells how to do these searches. So, if we're taking an item with us to the jail, inventory search is the likely way to go for the officer, not the search incident arrest for the items that he's carrying, like his person. Yeah, that's search incident arrest. Things in his pocket, that's search incident arrest. That's automatic, but it's the carried belongings where you have the problems. All right, and then last but not least, so not a search and seizure myth, but I threw in a Miranda one. Anybody that knows me knows I'm a Miranda's one of my favorite little subtopics. And just because you're not free to leave doesn't mean you are in custody for Miranda purposes, right? So, we all know what, so as many of you have heard me say, we give out way too many Miranda warnings in our profession. I call them Miranda gift bags, these free, unearned warnings. The person's got to be in custody before you, and you have to have the intent to interrogate them before Miranda is required. And the notion of what is custody is, it can be a little bit of it's a term of art, first of all, and the Supreme Court hasn't done a phenomenal job, but most of our officer citizen contacts don't require Miranda. Voluntary contacts, Miranda's never required because they're not in custody. Arrest, of course it is if you're going to ask them questions, interrogate them. But Terry stops and traffic stops, this is where most of our over-Mirandizing occurs. It's usually not required, even though they're not free to leave. So not free to leave is the test for whether you seized someone. That's the Fourth Amendment test. Whether I have whether they're in custody. This is the actual question we want to ask, and particularly the part I have highlighted in red. So on my Terry stops, how do I know if somebody's in custody? The ultimate question is, have I restrained this person's freedom of movement to the degree normally associated with being arrested? Or I rephrase that, have I used arrest-like measures on this person? Like these kinds of things. Is he locked in the back of my patrol car? That's most American citizens who watch Law and Order would say, hey, when Elliot and Olivia lock you in the back of their car, they slap the handcuffs on you. That looks like someone who's going to go to jail, not somebody who's just being briefly detained for questioning. So handcuffing, locking people in the back of the cars, surrounding people with a bunch of officers, like a whole platoon of officers, or like the picture here, some of you, that's your entire police department. Those physical types of restraints are typically the things that we look for on our Terry stops to create custody. If your Terry stop doesn't look like one of these things, they're not under arrest, they're just being detained, they're probably not in custody, even though they're not free to leave. All right. Well, oh, so but it's not automatic. It's not handcuffing. I just want to throw that real quickly and lock the car. It doesn't automatically create Miranda custody. Although if I had a scale of like in custody, not in custody, I slap somebody in handcuffs, that scale tilts heavily towards being in custody without some kind of mitigating efforts on part of the officers. Now, last point, interrogating at a police station though, that's where you're not free to leave. Test works fine. You can just ask, would a reasonable person feel like they're free to leave? Would a reasonable person feel like they can get up and walk out of this room without any legal consequences? Yes or no. That's how we test for custody, because we don't do Terry stops in police stations. If a reasonable person would feel like they're not free to leave a police station, they would believe they were under arrest. So there's our top our 10 of our common search and seizure myths. We could do another one. I could probably come up with 10 more, but hopefully you guys found this beneficial. This kind of a different format than what we've been doing. So if you want to bring blue to gold, any of our instructors to your agency, reach out to Erin. She's our training manager here, our training vice president. She takes care of all that kind of stuff. She's phenomenal and easy to work with. So shoot her an email.